Awesome. Thank you. President, ladies and gentlemen, Martin, thank you very much for that warm introduction. It's an enormous honour for me to be invited to give the Ashby Lecture today. As you see, on Lessons from America, the impact of universities on their region and the world. It's particularly nice to be welcomed with an introduction like that and all of the links that I have to Cambridge being very much brought out, links as a student, links spending three of the transformative years of my life as a scientist working in the chemistry department with Sir Alan Battersby, and of course years spent at St John's. Then that link to Cambridge came back, as Martin mentioned, at Yale. It was Alison Richard, who, as provost of Yale, who recruited me to Yale in the first place. And then Alison, of course, left to come to Cambridge, followed by Susan Hockfield as provost, who then went to become president of MIT, and then I followed Susan as provost. And so it's a great pleasure to come full circle and to be here this evening and talk about something which is very much on all of our minds. And I have to confess, with a word like impact in my title, I have to express a degree of unease about using that word. However, I am assured that I am not expected to shine a prophetic light on what our friends in Whitehall, who are drawing up the new research excellence framework, and what for whom impact is the new buzzword, I'm not expected to explain what they may eventually mean by that. And for that, I have great relief. And who knows, perhaps speeches like this will one day qualify as impact. And with in the ref, which, given how little time I seem to spend in my research lab these days, may be welcome news for my own university. For my purpose this evening, I want to rely on the Oxford English Dictionary for a definition of impact, which is something that has a marked effect or influence. And, of course, come to think of it, the Oxford English Dictionary itself would take some beating as an example of the deep cultural impact of scholarly endeavour. A Chinese university president who was visiting Oxford recently told us that as a boy, Oxford was the only foreign university he'd heard of because he'd learned English from an Oxford English Dictionary. Having a marked effect or influence on society is something that the collegiate universities of Oxford and Cambridge have been doing for more than 800 years. So it's a topic about which we should know something. But as I shall hope to demonstrate this evening, one about which we can also learn more, including from our peer institutions across the Atlantic. I must also confess, Martin, to a degree of apprehension at the prospect of addressing you on university impact, bearing in mind your first-hand knowledge, as you've just described this evening, of this subject over many years. As Vice-Chancellor of Manchester University, you were the architect of the successful merger between the Victoria University of Manchester and, of course, the University of Manchester Institute of Science and Technology, those two great 19th century foundations whose establishment was linked closely to that city's influence on the life of the Northwest region, the nation, and the rest of the world. Of course, in addition to being president of Clare Hall, you are also, Martin, the director of the Office for Fair Access, and may I say, without wishing, I hasten to add, of being accused of currying favour as offer scrutinises my university's access agreement, may I also add that in you we have a strong advocate of the principle that students of real talent should have the opportunity to develop their academic potential in outstanding places of learning and research, regardless of their background. It's a principle that has served our two universities well and will continue to do so. Eric Ashby, as we've heard, in whose honour this lecture series is named, was himself an embodiment of how academia contributes to the wider world through teaching and research. A distinguished authority in the area of the plant sciences, Ashby's research had an impact which stretched well beyond these shores. His involvement in the founding of Clare Hall is something for which everyone here this evening has cause to be grateful. My own qualifications for giving a lecture on the lessons that might be learned from across the Atlantic about impact derive, as you've heard, from 30 years working in US universities, first at Princeton University, and then for a number of years at the University of Pittsburgh, and more recently at Yale, as you've heard, where I served as provost. But before I proceed, I would like to make three general points. To compare US with UK universities runs the risk, of course, of comparing apples with oranges. Not only do US universities operate within very different social, cultural, and political contexts, but there is also a huge disparity in endowed wealth. We'll come back to this later. Second, the US higher education sector, like our own, contains huge internal diversity. Third, as I've already intimated, neither the American nor the UK sector has all the answers. And things that may work in one setting may not work or may not even be possible in another. That said, I do believe that we face some common challenges, and so I want to focus on three areas where I believe the experience of our US peers can be instructive. Let me see if I can get this to work. The three areas are the impact of universities on their regions and local communities, their impact on national life, and also their impact on the international knowledge economy. Let me first focus on the local and the regional. This is arguably how impact is most commonly understood today. The concept of the engaged university is very much à la mode. Whether it is in terms of varied economic impact, sharing of cultural heritage and facilities, environment and green spaces, staff and student volunteering, lifelong learning, or educational outreach and widening participation. The UK sector now buzzes with terms such as public engagement, community relations, regional liaison, so-called town and gown relationships have not, of course, always been harmonious. And I will not dwell on the events surrounding the Scholastica Day riots of 1355 in Oxford and the subsequent penalty forced upon the city of Oxford and its aldermen for nearly 500 years, but I hope to make my point with the following illustration, courtesy of Oxford Information. And for those of you who can read this, what it says, that there are, after that Scholastica Day riot, there are historic battlefields on which less blood has been spilt than in the streets of Oxford. Although I am confident that relations between university and city have improved significantly since then. But it's a relationship that we, as you, take very seriously. Like Cambridge and many other universities, we invest and participate in a wide range of community activities. A handful of them are shown here, involving, of course, the role of our museums, role of various activities throughout the day, and, of course, important areas of encouragement for student involvement with the community. We also very much try to communicate the benefits that we bring to the region, and sometimes our partners in Oxford do that for us. And this wonderful advertisement from the mini plant, of course, is one that we're very fond of. Now, Ivy League universities also face challenges when it comes to what we now call social cohesion. Tensions can arise out of perceived divergence of interests, that the institution, the university, is located in a community, but not really part of it. In the case of Yale, as Martin said in his introduction, its relationship with the New Haven community has over centuries been of the kind that sometimes would give our medieval town gown clashes a run for their money. For example, tensions found expression in riots between Yale students and local New Haven people in 1806, 1841, 1854, 1919, and even as late as 1959, with the so-called St. Patrick's Day snowball riots. And at Yale, the urban backdrop is very different from Oxford and Cambridge. And as Martin said, the area near to Yale College, particularly the downtown central business district of New Haven, has been a blighted area for more than half a century. This was an enormous problem in New Haven, particularly in the 1960s and 70s. You'll remember it's an area in New England. Let me just introduce to you, those of you who don't know Yale, this is the city of New Haven. This is Long Island Sound. Long Island is down here. New York is here. Boston is up here. But of course, we see that the city of New Haven very much grew as the cities of Cambridge and Oxford around the university. The city of New Haven, like Oxford in many ways, is quite a significant manufacturing city. And like many New England cities in the 1980s, it underwent massive decline with the closing of many major factories and the loss of jobs. Certainly, for the Yale University, the city of New Haven was founded by John Davenport, incidentally, a graduate of Oxford University. And, of course, Yale University was founded in 1701 thanks to the philanthropy of Elihu Yale, who, when I was doing research after being announced as the Vice Chancellor of Oxford, I discovered that he originally intended his philanthropy to go to Oxford, but it was redirected by some scurrilous Yaleys, and they weren't Yaleys, of course, at that time, but his gift was given to Yale, and of course it became a very significant founding gift for the university, after which the university was named. Any of you who know Yale and New Haven, one of the delights of New Haven is that it's one of the very original New England cities that is centered around a green, and there is a perfect arrangement of eight squares, and that formed the core heart of the city. And then, of course, Yale University, shown here, really grew around the city, and the city grew around it, and it became quite a significantly elongated campus. But, of course, the decline in the fortunes of the city, the loss of jobs, led to serious economic challenges. And in the 1970s and 80s, there was great challenge for the university. This culminated in the early 1990s with the murder of a student in a mugging. And of course, the university began to recognize that it had to become involved in a very significant way with the city of New Haven. And certainly, there's a rather important element. Any of you who know the Yale University, smack in the middle of the university is the Grove Street Cemetery. This is one of the oldest cemeteries in New England. It's the, where many Yale presidents, a number of signators of the Declaration of Independence are buried there. Morse of Morse code fame is buried there. Many significant figures. But just let me, as a diversion, there are two of my favorite gravestones in the Grove Street Cemetery. And let me show you these. These two gravestones are the gravestones of two famous chemists, John Kirkland on the left-hand side, and the very distinguished, famous Norwegian physicist Lars Onsager. They were both at Yale at the same time in the 1940s and 50s. They were great rivals for recognition. They were great rivals in the world of physical chemistry. Sadly, Kirkland died early. He died in 1959. And you'll see, it's hard to read. You don't need to read it. But his gravestone is a little bit like his curriculum vitae. And he lists his many prizes. He lists the major lectures he gave. And it really is a wonderful example. Now, of course, this becomes an opportunity for one-upmanship from the grave. Because Lars Onsager was similarly famous. But Lars Onsager, in addition to many distinguished lectures, in addition to being a member of the National Academy as Kirkland, Lars Onsager won the Nobel Prize. And on his gravestone was written, Nobel Laureate, asterisk. And then as we look down, etc. And so he wanted that moment of one-upmanship from the grave for eternity. And these two great rivals now live for eternity by the side of each other, still trying to score points. But anyway, this is the challenge that Yale faced in the early 1990s, and it was the challenge that my former boss, Rick Levin, as was mentioned in the introduction, really began to focus on. The survival of the university literally depended upon an engagement of Yale with New Haven in a very significant way. And there are some important lessons I think we in Oxford and you in Cambridge can learn from this. We have very different challenges. But one of the first was the importance of the areas surrounding the university. And again, let's not worry about detail. This is the New Haven Green. This is Yale University, elongated, stretching up. That's the Grove Street Cemetery I pointed out. But what was happening was this area was becoming blighted and becoming unsafe for students to walk in. And you can imagine what happened to applications to Yale. They plummeted. It became a very serious issue. The key step that was taken was to establish at the highest level of the university an office that would focus on New Haven and state affairs. That was a new step for the university. As I said, Rick Levin established the Office of New Haven State Affairs. Any of you who know him, Rick Levin is, Martin introduced him as the longest serving Ivy League university president by far. He's also a graduate of Merton College, Oxford. And he's someone I can't tell you how delighted he was. Last year, of course, former provosts of Yale were the vice chancellors of Oxford and Cambridge. And so you can imagine what pleasure he got from that. But this was a very key step because he recruited a Yale graduate, a man called Bruce Alexander, who's still the vice president for New Haven and State Affairs. Bruce was a property developer, a career of property development throughout the United States, and he brought that expertise to New Haven. And one of the first things that he did, if I can just go back one slide, I'm not going to go through detail, but I want to give one example of the kinds of steps that a university with a focused emphasis can have profound effects on the region. There's a part of New Haven, this is called Broadway, very close to the university. This was one of the worst areas in the 1980s, and it gives us an example of what can be done. Bruce Alexander, with the help, of course, of a growing Yale endowment, focused on the Broadway area, and blighted and empty shops were acquired by Yale. And all of those shops were then significantly refurbished, and they were rented to new retail outlets. And critically, it sounds like a rather trivial thing, but two very important things were included in the details of those rental contracts. The first was that each of those shops must stay open until 9 o'clock. So they would be open after dark, there would be light, there would be activity, the streets would become safer. And then there was another genius step, and that was to require in a number of the retail outlets that they must at all times have flowers for sale on the pavement, on the sidewalk. And that, next time you go to Manhattan, look at how many of those corner convenience stores have flowers outside. In an instant, the level of the neighborhood was raised. It became a delightful place, a charming place. It became a very lively and, of course, immediately a much safer place. So real focus of expertise, surprising to find in a university, but absolutely necessary, was brought forward. And this, of course, led to a very significant recognition of the role of the university in driving that change. There, here's another couple of examples. Of course, the University at Yale, as in Cambridge, as in Oxford, has a very important cultural role to play in the development of the cultural magnet that the city becomes. Yale was no exception. But again, this was entirely absent in the 70s and 80s. The university museums were very little visited, and it was a major emphasis on the Peabody Museum of Natural History. The Yale Center for British Art, that was where I first met Sir Martin Harris at the dinner for the Tanner trustees. And then the University Art Gallery opposite just there, the British Arts Center. And these two great buildings, again, another key role of architecture, great architecture. They are the first and the last buildings of the great architect Louis Kahn, the first and the last buildings in the United States, and became very important as part of that magnetism that the downtown area of New Haven was revitalized by this link to Yale. And that led to a very significant sense of emerging entertainment districts. Again, particularly in this area around the New Haven Green, not only cinemas, but also theaters. You can sense a real comprehensive focus on cleaning up the downtown. And that, of course, then changed the feel of the place magnificently. Here's a picture of the New Haven Green and the Metropolitan Opera on the New Haven Green, unimaginable in New Haven in the 70s and 60s, but now really creating, even on hot, steamy summer nights, a sense of lively activity. Of course, with cultural change was an absolutely necessary change in the economic underpinning of the city. Manufacturing industry in New Haven had essentially been abolished, had declined, and so the university started to play a key role in taking old factories, and in fact this is the Winchester factory. New Haven was a great center for arms manufacturing. It provided the armaments for the Union side in the Civil War. This is the old Winchester factory. It was turned with surrounding buildings into a science park. And a building that was emptied, was abandoned by the telephone company, became an incubator for science spin-out companies. Very important role of the university in providing the fertile ground that then led through the encouragement of venture capital to come into the city, and this was done both with the state of Connecticut and the university establishing venture funds, and then developing within the university the Yale Entrepreneurial Institute, encouraging students, as I know you have here in Cambridge, and we certainly do in Oxford, encouraging students to become involved in the entrepreneurial life of the city. This became a key part of the rejuvenation of the city, and from that, many biotechnology firms started to come into the city. We won't talk about them any detail, but suddenly a city that had been bereft of economic activity through manufacturing started through the focus of the university. I can assure you, very often looking at Cambridge as a model, it pains me to say it, but as a model for how effectively these things can be done. And Yale was able to learn from that, a good example of knowledge going in the other direction across the Atlantic. Very important part. And again, you can see New Wall Street Journal, the whole sense of buzz, the role that Yale has played in drawing interest. This is a new apartment and office building that's just been built in New Haven. Improvements in the infrastructure. Here is a new train station, very much part of this consequence of Yale's investment in the city. And I want to just touch upon two things that I think we can learn from on this side of the Atlantic. It was very important for the university to start improving neighborhoods in the area of the university. Here's one example. This is the Rose Center. The Rose Center is where the university, there were old abandoned buildings before, the university built a police department. And that police department became not only the center for the local police, but became a community center where evening classes and very much involvement with the local young people in the community became a way of bringing them into contact in a positive way with the police. A second, and again, very imaginative development at Yale that has now been seen as best practiced and has been followed by many other universities around America, has been the Yale Homebuyer Program. Again, how do you take derelict neighborhoods, neighborhoods filled with drug dealers? Here are a couple examples of buildings that were in very derelict, downtrodden areas. How do you encourage the uplift of that community? And one of the ways that Yale did it was to encourage Yale employees, from the janitor to the president, to buy those houses, and Yale would then provide the funds to renovate those houses. And so the Yale Home Buyer Program was a system whereby Yale employees, no matter where they were in the university, were given funds for the down payment on a house, were given a significant amount of money to help pay the monthly mortgage costs of the house, and were given money to renovate. And what happened was that derelict areas became leafy, suburban, delightful, strengthened, and most importantly, safe areas. So again, very important role for the university in providing a significant impact on the health of the city. This has gone further, and just in the last year, Yale has made a commitment to support the college costs of children in the most deprived areas of New Haven. And so here is Rick Levin again committing, this is the local newspaper, to support students from the deprived areas of New Haven, and again, raising educational opportunities for them, and that college would be free, supported by Yale's endowment. But of course, you can imagine how an imaginative program like this galvanizes the alumni and galvanizes their involvement in giving and supporting the kind of opportunities that can then lead to raising aspirations in areas that remain, even to this day, quite challenging and deprived areas of New Haven. It's a step of engaging with the community. And of course, that engagement with the community can also very much be reinforced by the involvement of our students. And Dwight Hall is the community involvement organization at Yale. It was founded in 1886. It has its own endowment. It's entirely self-funded. More than 50% of the undergraduate population at Yale is involved in community outreach, community volunteering, and it's organized through Dwight Hall. And in Oxford, I can assure you, the students organizing community activities there look to Dwight Hall as a model not only of success through the number of students involved, but also a model of how we can encourage, organize, and fund student involvement with the community. I want to just mention Oxford and Cambridge are both part of an international group called IARU, the International Alliance of Research Universities. And one of the great benefits of that, Yale is also, is that we have been learning about the strength of alumni activities at Yale and how to build those that to strengthen the Oxford alumni. And I know that Cambridge's alumni organization is learning much as well. Recently, there has been enormous success throughout the United States of alumni volunteering on a Saturday, one Saturday a year, in 250 sites around the world, not just the US. So members of the Yale alumni volunteering, refurbishing community centers, doing all manner of different things. It becomes a way of reinforcing the alumni spirit, the Yale spirit, but doing it in a way that, of course, has profound and important community advantages. And one of the amazing developments just in the last few years at Yale is that they have now taken this alumni involvement with communities out to the world. And so each year now, and you can see it's happening twice a year in March and in July, a large group of alumni, 150 alumni, travel to a part of the developing world and become involved in similar improving a hospital, building a new community center in the Amazonian jungle. With that group of alumni go architects, doctors, and they create and improve a local community, medical, also building new facilities. It becomes an enormously powerful way of strengthening the strengthening not just the benefit to the community, but also the role of the alumni. And lastly, let me just finish with one example. Again, for those of us in universities in the United Kingdom, the news from the pharmaceutical industry is a very troubling one. But I just want to show you something that became very much on the radar of Yale while I was provost. A major pharmaceutical research center owned by Bayer Pharmaceuticals was abandoned, was closed down by the German headquarters. It was an enormous property, 136 acres, 1.6 million square feet of space. It was 7 miles from the central campus, just a little bit down I-95, any of you who know New England. And this became an opportunity for the university to invest not only in developing an abandoned research site, but also many opportunities for the university to use that research site to strengthen its research activities. So this is now known as the Yale West Campus. And to give you a little sight, it's 136 acres, immense in scale, but of course with state-of-the-art laboratories, rather elegant and delightful walks through forests and offices as well. But as we in universities around the UK are challenged by the closing of AstraZeneca, the closing of the Pfizer site in Sandwich, there is much to be learned about how these things have been handled in the US. Recently, the University of Michigan took over the Park Davis site in Ann Arbor, Michigan, again, using it as a significant opportunity not only to strengthen the research infrastructure of the university, but most importantly, to ensure that there are opportunities for job development and job security. I like to show this because this is the West Campus that was acquired while I was provost. That's the West Campus on the Yale campus. So you can see almost the same size. That's the West Campus on MIT. So a really major acquisition and an opportunity for the university to greatly benefit from the facilities that are acquired. So let me move in many ways to the next step in my lecture, because I've talked about the impact of universities on the region. And in some ways, Yale's physical setting could hardly be more different from that of Oxford and Cambridge in our cities, constraints on space and the costs of maintaining historic buildings, as well as the challenges of reconciling their educational uses with their great attraction to visitors. Those may be more pressing problems for us. But I hope that this very brief tour of the city and the campus serves to demonstrate that no university, wherever it is situated, can expect to prosper in the 21st century unless it demonstrably promotes and serves the overall flourishing of the community in which it's set. Now let's move on to the national level. The value and the importance of universities to the nation, their national impact, has been at the forefront of the public debate in this country in recent months, there's no question. Much has been made of the private benefit, as well, of course, of the cost to the individual of a good university education. I am concerned that not enough attention is being paid to the profound public benefit. Indeed, the sheer public necessity of a world-class university sector. It is the foundation for our shared hope of a prosperous, civilized future. Failure to invest publicly in higher education is a failure to invest in that future. We need properly funded universities, and we need to educate those with the greatest potential, irrespective of their financial circumstances or background, so that the many contributions they can make to society in the future are fully realized. At Oxford and Cambridge, we make much, rightly, in my view, of our intensive, highly personalized approach to teaching the small interdisciplinary academic communities that are fostered by our collegiate structure. These also underpin our high rankings in successive student experience surveys and our low student dropout rates. It is an approach that not only sets us apart from most other UK universities, but I can assure you it is admired and envied in the Ivy League. And what may you may reasonably ask, should we envy about the Ivy League? One answer is probably its level of endowment. And certainly we all know what a challenge that is in Oxford and in Cambridge when we are dealing with endowments among our principal competitors of that scale. But there's much more to envy. The US has a net entry rate at tertiary level of 65%. compared with 55% in the UK. The US spends 2.9% of GDP on higher education, the highest rate in the OECD, and more than double the UK proportion of 1.3%. And a much larger proportion of higher education expenditure comes from private sources in the US, 66%, and indeed in Japan, 68%, than in the UK, which now sits at 35% from private sources. One of the interesting things that this comparison highlights is the combination in the US of high participation and high investment, based principally on larger contributions from private sources. The high fee structure is not a disincentive to access because of the bursary system. US competitors, because of these numbers, can offer very generous bursaries to offset high fees. One of the interest, that said, my own experience over many years in both US and UK universities convinces me that there is no one-size-fits-all answer to the challenges of university access and entry. There are, for example, significant differences when it comes to size and shape of the student body, particularly at undergraduate level. Oxford and Cambridge provide significantly more undergraduate places than Harvard and Yale. You can see this slide compares the number of full-time undergraduate places in Oxford compared with those of Harvard and Yale. At Oxford, we have well over 11,000 undergraduates. They constitute 62% of our total full-time body. By contrast, undergraduates constitute only 36% of the student body at Harvard and 46% at Yale. The contribution to national higher education of Oxford and Cambridge is substantial. Both provide around 1% each of undergraduate places in the UK. In comparison, Yale's 5,254 undergraduates represent just 0.03% of US undergraduate places. Even if the places offered by the 6 or 7 leading research-intensive US institutions are aggregated, their percentage contribution to national provision is still much smaller than either Oxford or Cambridge. A particular characteristic of the US system is the targeted approach to student recruitment. We've heard much on this topic in the UK in recent weeks. On the basis of SAT tests, that is standardized general aptitude tests taken typically by 18-year-olds for university admission, on the basis of those tests, institutions can obtain contact details of students from particular backgrounds, such as ethnic backgrounds, who score above a certain threshold. They are then able to write personalized letters to each of these students. In addition, Harvard and Yale devote an immense amount of time and attention to the major nationwide high school academic competitions. Again, they are able to access the contact details of the winners and write to them directly. At Harvard, around 70% of each incoming class and 90% of ethnic minority students are first identified using these two search and target systems. By contrast, UK universities can only contact students via their schools. Schools, as we know, will not give out contact details of students because of data protection law. We cannot approach students directly and therefore have to rely on approaching them via teachers. This is partly why at Oxford, and I know also at Cambridge, we focus much of our effort on teacher engagement. I was, however, interested to hear that the Higher Education Minister, David Willetts, has asked his advisers to ascertain whether it would be lawful and feasible for universities to have access to the grades of students at GCSE level. US universities are allowed to take race and other factors into account when making admissions decisions. In the UK, that is unlawful. The curriculums in the UK and the US, of course, are constructed very differently. In the US, students expect to complete a broad range of academic courses. No applicant for an undergraduate place will know for certain what they are going to major in when they apply. So looking for subject-specific aptitude has limited relevance in the US. Candidates are admitted on the basis of many different factors, including extracurricular talents, academic ability, well-roundedness overall, and other factors in addition to academic talent. By contrast, UK universities tend to recruit, as we know, for single or joint honours courses that the students will study throughout their 3 or 4 years at the university. There are also marked differences at graduate level between the UK and US universities, especially when it comes to financial support. For example, a growing number of US universities, including not only Harvard, Princeton, Yale, and Stanford, but also now NYU, Columbia, and Brown, they all provide 5-year full funding packages for nearly all of their doctoral students, including their humanities doctoral students. By contrast, at Oxford, 60% of our graduate students are on full scholarships, and that ranges from about 40% in the humanities and social sciences to 70% in the sciences and medical sciences. We are under investing in our graduate students. We will lose the best and the brightest to those US universities. Increasing our support for graduate scholarships is a major priority for Oxford's fundraising campaign. Our strategic objective is to provide full funding packages to the overwhelming majority of students studying for doctorates. The challenge for us and for the UK generally is to ensure that we attract the very best students, regardless of their country of origin or their family's wealth. Additional scholarships are needed to attract and retain a continued flow of talented graduates to strengthen our position as global research leader and to contribute to the growth of international knowledge exchange. Postgraduate education is a highly successful part of the UK's higher education system. For it's a matter of great regret to us that the Brown Review devoted so little time and attention to it. The growing presence in our universities of students from all over the world, especially at the graduate level, is a major dimension of my third and my final area, international impact. And let me just spend a few moments discussing that in more detail. Across the globe, the number of students studying abroad has shot up to more than 3 million, a 75% increase since 2003. In economic terms, the UK higher education exports earn more than £5 billion per annum for the UK economy. In the US, international students and their dependents are worth an estimated $16 billion a year. But this international marketplace in academics and students is not only of economic value. It makes a huge contribution to the cultural life of the host nation. Rick Levin, the current president of Yale, put it well when he said, "We want to do a good job of educating students for 21st century leadership, and you cannot be cross-culturally literate and be 21st, you cannot be, excuse me, you cannot be cross-culturally illiterate and be a 21st century leader." Like Cambridge, Oxford attracts outstanding students from all over the world, from more than 140 countries in our case, many of whom will use the knowledge and skills they've gained in Oxford to make significant contributions back home. We are, for example, very proud to have educated world leaders such as the current Indian Prime Minister Manmohan Singh, the Burma democracy leader Aung San Suu Kyi, former US President Clinton, and the former Pakistani Prime Minister Benazir Bhutto. This is a virtuous circle that brings benefits in many fields and in many different ways. I think, for example, of our master's course in global health science, which attracts students who return to their own countries better equipped to assume leadership positions in major healthcare organizations and national ministries of health. Today, non-UK students make up one-third of Oxford's total student body. This includes 14% of our full-time undergraduates and 63% of our postgraduate students. Global competition for the brightest and best staff and students is growing massively. Our competitors are not only the Ivy League, but increasingly they are to be found in China and in India. China now attracts 265,000 foreign students. That is a greater number than the 180,000 Chinese students who study outside China each year. China is on track to produce several world-class universities within one or two generations. International impact is not just about the students and staff who come to us. Universities like Oxford and Cambridge are also engaged in many important ways over the globe. One can point to Oxford's tropical medical laboratories, for example, in Thailand, in Vietnam, and in Kenya, and also to other outposts of the university in Laos, in Indonesia, and in China. Projects like these are living examples of the practical difference a university can make to people's lives in places where that is so sorely needed. A number of US peer institutions and indeed some UK universities have put down academic roots in other ways by opening new campuses. That's not on our agenda at Oxford, but we do regard the international presence in many countries of Oxford University Press as a significant part of our educational activity and engagement. OUP is the largest academic publisher in the world, with offices in more than 50 countries. Its English language teaching materials and school books, its textbooks and reference books are a vital tool for students all over the world. So the impact of universities in the global arena depends on the creativity, the judgment and the decision-making of thousands of talented individuals, on forging new links and alliances. But it also depends upon the commitment of policymakers to create a regulatory environment that promotes such links. The numbers of international students in the US dropped dramatically after 9/11, following the tightening of student visa regulations. Economic recession and currency exchange rates played a significant part, but it was widely accepted that visa regulations were a key factor in the 20% drop in student visas in 2002. They remained at that level for 2 years. The total enrollment of foreign students in the US declined in 2003 for the first time in two decades, down 2.4%, with a further 1.3% reduction in 2004. It was not until 2005 when there was investment to speed up the procedures and some rules relaxed that student numbers began to rebound. And here in the UK, new lower limits on the number of international academics that we can recruit or retain poses serious risks, both scholarly and economic. And while I am relieved that international students will be allowed to work for a period in the UK after graduation in graduate-level jobs, I believe that the closure of the post-work mechanism is unfortunate. This is an area where heeding the experience of the US may serve us well. This has been, this evening, a very cursory overview of a very large subject. But let me just add a few words in conclusion. There are, I believe, significant lessons about the wide-ranging impact of universities that can be learned from the US. But that does not mean that what works there will necessarily work here. The lesson to be learned may involve adaption, refinement, or even rejection of a particular approach to the many issues that world-leading universities have in common. And it's by no means a one-way traffic. I can assure you that there are many, many things about Oxford and Cambridge that are deeply admired and even envied in the Ivy League, a collegiate system very much being one of them. And there are also certain things that transcend transatlantic differences. For a university on either side of the pond to continue to compete globally, I believe it must be able to attract the best and the brightest students, irrespective of background or origin. It needs to be well and securely funded from a healthy mix of public and private sources. And it must have a strong regard for its neighbours. For if our neighbours are unaware of the benefits we bring, why should they support us in building the future on which our national reputations and our international reputations and impact ultimately rest? And so, ladies and gentlemen, I hope that this evening I've given you a sense of where in the US, particularly at Yale, a very profound transformational effect can be gained. But we can also see at the national and international level, as well as the regional, a very, very important role and a very important impact for universities, yes, in the US, but universities like Oxford and Cambridge in the UK. Let me once again thank you for doing me the great honour of being the Ashby Lecturer this evening. I want to thank you very much for bringing an end to what has been a very exciting day for Jenny and me. It's a day that will live long in the memory, and I thank you very much for your attention. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you, Matthew. You can see, can't you, ladies and gentlemen, when we first met Andy in Yale 2 years ago, we were absolutely determined to try and persuade him to come and talk with us this evening. Thank you very much indeed. There's time for about two or three questions, please.
You gave examples of the way world-class universities can attract private funding. At a time when public funding is being cut in the UK, what can a world-class university do?
At a time when public funding is being cut, indeed it is. And as I said in my words, with great concern for all of us, the lessening of public support. Of course, we must remember that public support for universities comes in a number of forms. It comes in the form of support for research. And indeed, one of the great reliefs for all of us was the protection of, or the essential flatlining of, research funding as a result of the Comprehensive Spending Review. But of course, we've seen huge cuts for teaching funding and huge cuts for capital funding. At this point, I think for all of us, relatively under explored the impact that the reduction in capital funding will have on our long-term plans here in Cambridge and certainly in Oxford. What can we do? We must focus on strengthening the other sources of income that we do have some control over. What are those? Yes, in terms of private support for education, that will be higher fees, as Cambridge and Oxford and many other universities have committed to, but only in the presence of generous bursaries and fee waivers. Yes, it means a greater emphasis, as Cambridge has led the way, in royalty income, in income from that comes from the discoveries of our laboratories and our research centres. But of course, very important will be the strengthening of our philanthropic underpinning. The Cambridge campaign has been marvellously successful, reached the £1 billion mark 3 months before Oxford. We reached the £1 billion mark. It was very distressing to all of us that Cambridge reached it first. However, Oxford started their campaign 3 years after Cambridge, so that gave us some solace. But seriously, it's obviously we face major challenges, but of course we must support the world-class research and teaching that our universities are renowned for, and the way that can be done is by strengthening the private support for those activities.
Hello.
Yes.
Thanks. Thank you for the lecture. Just have a question, actually. When I was back in States, they're very close collaborative programs, like between MIT and Harvard, and they collaborate very closely, and they have joint degrees, and they have common things where they try to move forward. Does Oxford and Cambridge have something similar to it? And if not, why?
In terms of joint degrees, certainly we have, and Cambridge has had a wonderful collaboration with MIT over many years. The student exchange programs are very strong and involve many universities in the US, but at this point, not joint degrees. And I think, certainly for Oxford, I can speak, we do not have significant involvement in joint degrees. Part of what we look for is opportunities to ensure that students have the chance to come and spend time, whether it's during their undergraduate studies or, of course, whether it's during graduate studies after an undergraduate degree in the US. Is that what you were...
No, I was asking okay. For between Oxford and Cambridge, like MIT and Harvard...
Oh, I see what you... Oh, I thought you were meaning between Oxford and Cambridge and MIT. Between Oxford and Cambridge, again, no, I think we... there's an interesting question. Boris, over dinner tonight, we'll... shall we discuss a merger of... that would get the press buzzing. Let me say, and in fact you make a serious point, of the benefits of closer collaboration between Oxford and Cambridge. It struck me as I sped across from Oxford to Cambridge today, you know, we aren't that far apart. And when you look at the San Francisco Bay Area, the distance between Oxford and Cambridge is not that different from the distance across San Francisco Bay. We should be collaborating much more in this part of the country, particularly when you include UCL and Imperial. We have a very strong concentration of world-class universities. We can benefit greatly from collaborating around major scientific initiatives, major pieces of scientific instrumentation. There is much to be gained. I think it'll be a while before Oxford and Cambridge have a joint degree. The first thing we'd have to decide is which one comes first, Oxford or Cambridge, in the title.
Time for one more. Please, right at the back.
The greatness of the US system was its scale. You know, the universities that you're talking about are educate about 1% of the total. And the almost total absence of fees for decades, which was a system that allowed generations of low-income and middle-income people to attend that had never imagined before that they would have the capacity to do that. What's happening now is, or actually not now, but for the last 30 years, is the moving towards the system that you are describing as a solution for Oxford and Cambridge, which is more philanthropy, which is targeted very specifically and doesn't really help operating expenses, more research, which in the United States at least costs universities money rather than increasing revenues, and higher fees, which in the U.S. experience has for the last 20 years been lowering overall levels of educational attainment in my state of California and in other states in the United States. So my question is this. Instead of suggesting these complicated adaptations of a system that is no longer working very well in the U.S. context overall, even if Yale is doing well, why not just call for the restoration of the great public enterprise system that we had after World War II?
Well, let me comment, and my words were very carefully chosen because I called in my speech this evening for the importance of significant public investment in higher education, significant public support in higher education. Obviously, my answer to the earlier question was the response to what has been, as has been the case in the great state universities of the US, significant cuts in funding at the state level. The challenge that I was asked in that question was, how do we maintain greatness in the face of declining public investment in the leading universities of the United Kingdom? I couldn't agree more with you that one of the great tragedies in the US, yes, I was at Yale and Princeton. I was also at the University of Pittsburgh, which is a state-related university, very similar to the great universities in California. One of the great tragedies is the decline in funding. It is now more expensive for many people to go to the University of Michigan than it is to go to Harvard and Yale with the level of financial aid that Harvard and Yale are able to provide. California, your state, was in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, one of the great examples of a system where a kid could go to a community college in South Central LA, and if they did well enough and worked hard enough, they could transfer and graduate from one of the great universities of the world, Berkeley. And the system allowed a level of social mobility that is profoundly missing in the changes that have occurred as a result of the reduction in funding. The fees, as you say, have gone up. We must be very concerned about it. We must continue to press, even as we go through in the UK this very difficult period of financial stricture from this government and cuts in our support. We must maintain the pressure that public funding for higher education is a public benefit and must be maintained when it becomes possible. Because the consequence, the alternative, I wouldn't say you were rather harsh in saying it's broken in the US. It's certainly damaged in the US. And that damage shows no signs of repair because we see ever reducing state support for the great state universities of the Midwest and of the West as well.
Can I bring the proceedings to an end by saying again to you, Andy, thank you so much for being here. I think you could tell from Andy's delivery, couldn't you, that he's come at the end of a very stimulating and exciting day. I think, Andy, that really showed it in your delivery. I think I would just like to say how important all the themes are you've touched on. I mean, I guess you would enable many of us to share that extraordinary experience of what Yale has done in a city that was really heading for disaster. Mm. Yale has been the great turnaround. But you've taken us on to a lot of other areas that I wasn't expecting to explore, which are absolutely relevant to everything that we're engaged in this university, and indeed in all our great research universities. And you're absolutely right, the balance between public and private is being tilted very sharply one way, with consequences that are not as yet wholly predictable, and I think we watch with some anxiety.
We do indeed.
These things that may happen. All I would just say, and I don't say this with any satisfaction is if you go back to the early 60s when everything in this university and similar universities was entirely free, and indeed there were very generous grants to support those people who came in as undergraduates, the proportion from socioeconomic groups D and E was exactly the same as it is now. So whatever else is at work there, there are factors that are far more complex than simply money. And all of those things make it a very, very difficult situation for us all to deal with. Enormously stimulating. Thank you very much indeed. Can we thank Andy again in the usual way?
Thank you. Thank you.